with the patterns of calming signals, if it's only one, if it's more, if there are pauses in between, or if they happen quite quickly or at the same time, you can definitely say there are tension levels that accompany it.
Welcome to Come Along for the Ride, a podcast for horse lovers everywhere, a place where we love to bring consciousness to the horse world. I'm your host, Tracy Malone, and this podcast is brought to you from my home in the Sanford Valley, in the northwest of Brisbane, Australia. This land I live on is Waka Waka and Turrbal country. I'd like to acknowledge the traditional custodians of this land and to pay my respects to their ancestors, past, present, and future. And I'd also like to extend that respect to each and every one of you listening. This episode is brought to you by Eden River Equestrian, soon to be Australia's leading sustainable horse brand. In just 2 weeks' time, on the 1st of May, I will be launching phase two of my dream to bring consciousness on every level to the horse world through organic and sustainable products, information, and community. Eden River Equestrian will be the new home for this podcast, so stay tuned for the new website and social media handles that we will transition to in May. Hopefully, all will go smoothly. In today's episode, I speak with Rachel Draysmer. Rachel is the incredible woman who brought us the book on calming signals for horses. Today, she tells her story of her teachers and mentors and how she came to write the book in the first place. We find out how she went about researching for her book and how long it took her to find what she was hoping for. Rachel also has some new and very interesting research and training that she's undertaking with horses and scent tracking. It's incredible to hear what she's been able to do so far. I won't keep you from Rachel any longer. Grab a cuppa and enjoy every minute of hearing from the woman who has inspired so many, not just of us, but of all the trainers that I've interviewed so far on this program. Here is Rachel. Rachel, thank you so much for joining me on the show today.
Oh, thank you so much, Tracy, for having me. I'm very looking forward to it. It is my first podcast, so I'm excited to do it.
And I'm so honored that I am your first podcast. That's amazing.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah. So can you tell me a little bit about, just in case everyone on the podcast who hasn't listened to anything before doesn't actually know what it is you do in the world, because I think most of us do, but tell me anyway a little bit about what it is that you do.
I think most people would know me from my book, Language, Science and Calming Signals of Horses. I've been writing it the last years and it's been published in 2017. And in the book, I set the results of my study that started in 2013, and it's a study about calming signals of horses, although it did expand, and it was not only about calming signals of horses.
Fantastic, and we're going to go definitely into that. But first of all, let's take a little step back. Have you always had horses as a part of your life? Did you grow up with them?
I think in my mind, definitely I did. I know I started saving for my own horse when I was six.
Wow.
And I think I was a typical horse girl, starting riding lessons at six, mucking stalls to be able to brush them. And at the age of 14, I got my first new forest pony, which was absolute one of the best days of my life. And I will be 50 next year, and actually I always had a horse in my life. I know I owned my horse. And I always lived with dogs as well. When I was at my motherly home and now as an adult. Yeah, so animals were always around me.
Yeah. Wonderful. And did you leave school and study something to do with animals and horses?
No, not initially. I studied Dutch at the university and I became a writer and studied marketing as well and worked at a marketing agency. Wow. And I quite clearly remember a moment, because one episode in my life, I studied Russian, and I had the Russian lesson, and the teacher said, like, you know, I work with dogs as a profession. And I felt such a pang of jealousy, and I thought, like, wow, because I'm not jealous at all by nature. So I thought, what is happening here? And I thought about it and I thought like, wow, you know, what if I would change professions? And that idea struck such a chord with me and I started changing professions. So I think I started in 2000 to get my diplomas to be a trainer, first for dogs and a behaviorist. And in 2003, I started my own business working full time as a dog trainer and behaviorist. Yeah.
How did that go? What was it like for you?
It was wonderful, and I was very ambitious and enthusiastic and always looking for new ways to see how I could improve and help people. And I clearly remember reading the book of Turit Bukhas, my friend and mentor now, about the calming signals of dogs. And it was like an eye-opener to me that I go like, wow, a new world was opening up in what I could see. And then there was this search of how do I implement the calming signals of dogs in my teaching methods? How will I use them? And I think I found a teaching method with dogs which was not as traditional as other dog schools had, but was a really good startup for what I'm doing with the horses, actually.
And how did that transition happen? So you said, first of all, you said that Turid is your friend and mentor. How did all of that happen?
Actually, I read that she would be coming to Calming Science, a dog education center in the Netherlands in 2012, and I attended her education. And that's when we met personally. So prior to our meeting, I read her book the 10 years prior and worked with it. But then meeting her live and working with her, yeah, it gave me such an in-depth information and such great tools to further expand my knowledge. It was wonderful, fundamental change in my life.
Oh, that you so and lucky then that you were able to do that.
Oh yes, absolutely. And then actually, Turit used to work with horses before she worked with dogs.
Really?
And obviously, yes, and quite professionally, and also with a big passion. And since my passion were horses as well, we started talking about them. And because when you work with dogs, everything you do with dogs, you will implement. You look at cats, you look at horses, you know, it's never in one species, right? It's a way of thinking and a way of observing.
Yeah.
So we were talking about that and we found our mutual passion. And when Turit asked me, like, why doesn't anyone chart the calming signals of horses? I thought that was my moment of queuing in and saying, now, that is something I would really like to do in life. And that's how it started, actually.
So, yeah. What happened next? So it's all well and good to have an idea. We all have loads of them. What was the first
step
that you made this happen? So what happened for you to, what was the process of you turning an idea into this amazing reality?
I think it helps that I was very practical. So I thought of, if I would want to do this, how can I do it that it's feasible? So I did not work with a university and I did not have, in that case, large amounts of money behind me. So I thought like, how can I make it work for me? And I thought of doing it by filming with my regular telephone, actually. And that's was a good thing because I found out that horses are very habituated, domesticated horses, to phones and sometimes not as well to cameras. So the phone turned out very well. So my first investment was a very good phone with the best filming quality back then. And I started filming because I thought I can study semi-feral horses, but then I have to travel quite a way to see them and observe them. And I thought like, well, that's not practical in my life and it probably will end there. So I thought if I do domesticated horses all around my neighborhood, and there's so many horses here, it's very feasible for me to do so. And I just started filming. And then sitting in the back and analyzing them and categorizing and trying to find out how to do the categorization. And well, it came to a working method. But it took quite a while, though, because I have been doing this for years and years. So I think my urge to find answers and to really know or, well, really know as if it's an absolute, which I don't know if we can say that, but the urge of finding out more about communication and horse language was so strong that it kept me going. It's almost like a puzzle, right? My seeking urge was on, and well, that doesn't need to stop, because we only are at the beginning, I think. There's so much more to discover.
Oh, yeah. That's exciting.
Very yes, exciting it is. Yeah.
So tell me about what it is that you found. What is a calming signal for anyone who doesn't actually know? And what is it that you, what did you find from all these recordings?
Well, what I was absolutely interested in was looking at signals horses might give each other when they want to appease each other. And I wanted to know, firstly, do they exist? Because in a way, Turrett has been studying these signals in dogs. And I've been working with these signals in dogs. And I knew, for instance, dogs have the yawning, the head turn, blinking. So I was very afraid that I would be in some sort of confirmation bias, and I wanted to see things that weren't there at horses. So filming helped me with that. And when looking at films, I was just wondering, like, if one horse meets another, will they appease each other? If they don't, why not? What are differences in circumstances? And these obviously are harder questions, but it all came down to noting eyes, ears, posture of the horse, the tail posture, his body posture. And then I started to notice that horses, as dogs and humans, sometimes use appeasement signals to prevent a conflict or a negative escalation. So, for instance, if... And, you know, maybe we can have an example with humans that is easier for people to connect with. Mm-hmm. If I live in a very small village, so if I meet people on the street, we say hello, we look in each other's eyes, we say hello, even if we don't know them. If I go shopping in the city and I pass people and they pass me frontally, I would look away and I would turn my head a little bit, and then we both walk on. The other person does the same. Now, that is something that has not been taught to me. My mother didn't tell me, like, if you're in the city and someone approaches you, you really have to turn your head and look away. No one said that to me. But it's something I do natural. And it is, in a way, I think, to prevent contact, to prevent an escalation, and to maintain a positive social bubble. Mm. And horses do the same. And obviously, if I meet my mother, I'm not going to maintain a positive social bubble. That's not necessary, because I know we have a very good relationship and I can meet her and skip the calming signals and skip that appeasement. But in some circumstances I do it. For instance, when I enter an elevator in a hotel and it's crammed with people and I enter, I give calming signals. I look away, I turn around, not feeling that comfortable. Yeah. So these signals, the appeasement signals, the calming signals that horses might use to calm the other and calm themselves, those were my scope of interest. Mm. And I found several, which is and was very exciting.
And so what did you do once you found them all?
And make a small dance in the living room. No, really. I was so excited. And I obviously shared it with friends and with
How Jared far we in were you when you found this? How many hours of video did you look at? Ooh. Like a couple of hours?
Oh, I think
weeks or months in.
Oh, no. I think a few months. I think only after 6 or 7 months of analyzing films. And I was quite frustrated at the beginning, because I thought I would recognize patterns earlier in the process. And while studying Dutch in the university, my professor always told me, if you study something and you do not find results, it's still very good to keep studying, because then at least someone else knows what not to do, which I thought was, you know, not very nice. But that thought was very comforting for me in the first months. So I thought, like, well, just keep on going and maybe I won't find anything, but still I have an area that has been covered by me. So it took quite a few months, actually. Yeah.
And then you found it. And were you watching videos every day for all of those months?
I think 5 days a week, yeah, a few hours a day, yeah.
Wow.
And actually up till now, I still watch, I think, 20 to 25 videos a week, yeah.
Wow.
And people send me in films and you see something on Facebook and you look at them and sometimes you question something like, hey, is it what I know it is, or is it different, and how is it different? So it's still a very nice thing to do. Mm-hmm. And yeah, necessary, I think. Yeah. But I mean, not seeing the signals is so, well, now I think it's maybe obvious because, for instance, the calming signal showing the flank, once you see it, you can recognize it. But horses have been doing it quite a while. But if you don't give meaning to it, you know, you will not recognize it. So it's such a strange thing to know. And people who visit my lecture say the same. They say, I cannot unsee it anymore.
Mm.
And that is something that is happening, which is.
And we also maybe termed it incorrectly as well. Sometimes we might have thought it was disrespect or misbehavior.
Yeah.
Or something like that, and signs of not interested in what it is that we're asking, instead of actually seeing it for what it is. That's, I think, the most amazing part about it.
And especially the calming signal showing hindquarters, as you say. Some people told me they were taught it was disrespect. Yep, that's true. But the body is so soft that it's not, and some people say it's a kick threat, but the calming signals of showing hindquarters is so different. It's with a very soft, long top line of the horse. He looks away, eyes up front to look at something else. It is as if he's not there looking at something else. And I'm in the Netherlands now and I'm, you know, looking away, pretending I'm showing you what it looks like. Obviously, you cannot see me. A bit strange, but
but you gave it a very good description, so I'm seeing it.
Okay, I hope so.
And because you're doing it in actions, I think everyone listening is kind of getting it, because as you're performing,
okay,
we're getting the feeling of it as well. Don't worry, I saw it clearly in my head.
Good. Oh, fun, yeah.
And so calming signals are essentially a body signal to let us know that whether or not they're able to handle a situation, whether or not they're understanding what's going on. What are they telling us with their calming signals?
Well, there are some steps to keep in mind when you look at calming signals. And it also depends on the features the horse shows at that moment. So for instance, when I did my study, I did not use heart rate variability programs, or I measured cortisol, or I didn't measure the eye temperature. So I can imagine if you put a heart rate variability machine on the horse, you will find an elevated heart rate with every change in his environment.
Mm.
As Sapolsky says in his book, Behave, right, that the body always, if I interpreted it right, but that the body gives a reaction, the brain gives a reaction. So I think when a horse is standing tied up, someone comes with the saddle and he's frontally facing him and walking towards him, if a horse is totally relaxed and fine with it, he will not show calming signals. It might be, however, that the horse interpreted the frontal fast approach as a little bit too fast, maybe impolite, and he might show a calming signal to calm the handler who approaches him, and maybe to reduce his own tension by doing so. And by doing that calming signal, it can be a blink, it can be a chew, it can be a tongue out chew, he might restore to a very relaxed homeostasis again, because it was a reaction to the frontal approach. It might also be that you will see a calming signal, same horse tied up, frontal approach shows a calming signal, the handler is tacking him, and the tension is building up more and more, and then you can see the features of the horse changing. He's getting a little bit more tense. Maybe his nostrils open, eyes open, maybe a little bit tense in the muscle, the mouth, lips clench. And then you might see more calming signals coming through and through. And then you might say the horse is still trying to appease and trying to calm himself, but he has more elevated tension. So to say what he means to say is a little bit hard because we never know, but I definitely can say that with the patterns of calming signals, if it's only one, if it's more, if there are pauses in between, or if they happen quite quickly or at the same time, you can definitely say there are tension levels that accompany it. And that is, I think, very useful. Is that an answer to your question?
Absolutely. And it's so helpful to understand these things. What happens if we know nothing about calming signals and we force the saddle on the horse anyway?
Well, obviously, it depends on your horse. And most horses will cope and they will get out and they will get ridden. And but I would say if I would look at the horse, I might see some underlying tension. And if we would work with the calming signals and we would notice it and we would respond to it by maybe taking a break, making a calming signal, noticing what is hard for the horse, maybe the frontal approach, we can make a program out of it, a trainings program or socialization program. You can adjust the horse to our way of living, or maybe adapt your behavior as well and skip the problem for the horse and maybe do a small curve towards the horse with the saddle in a less quick approach, which will make him comfortable enough and which will make him fine. So I think using or recognizing the calming signals and acting upon them is a tool to lessen the tension with the horse and making sure he, well, at least try to give him positive emotion with the things we are doing in the human world.
And you talk about a positive learning climate. Is that what you're meaning by a positive experience and positive emotions, or is the positive learning climate something different?
Yeah, I think I connect positive learning climate towards positive emotions. And with a positive emotion, I always practice myself to, if I'm practicing with a horse and I stop at any minute, I would love him to look at me and say like, hey, what's next? As if we are watching and playing a game or watching television. So a lot of people I find sometimes think their horse is very obedient and very satisfied with life, and this is not all horses, right? Mm-hmm. Only a percentage. I see that are disconnected and standing there with a very dull eye, not engaging. And I would like, with a positive learning climate, that a horse would approach me if I'm doing something and I stop, that he looks at me like, what's going on? Or that he is so relaxed, looking at the environment and looking what's going on, and is not bothered at all in what I'm doing. So that to me is a positive learning climate.
Mm. And we talk a bit about like a learned helplessness almost. Is that what you're talking about with a dull eye where the horse is just not responding?
Yeah. Yeah, I am. But there are many steps, or I'm looking for the word, and I'm tempted to use a Dutch word and pronounce it in English, but I don't know if it exists, but gradations. But it's like there are many steps of learned helplessness, of course. And I think a horse that is really depressed and then learned helplessness, if you start working with it, one of the characteristics is that it's very hard for him to take initiative. So if I would make an enriched environment for him, or if I would want to do nose work with him, there's a really big threshold for him to open up and to explore. which obviously is he's in a very bad state. But you also have a disconnection within very small moments. And the horse, in a different circumstances, is attentive and is willing to cooperate. So there are many many different levels of learned helplessness, to my view. Yeah. But you don't want to have it, obviously.
Absolutely. And you found that by understanding calming signals, you can free them from learned helplessness? Is that a word that would be used?
I don't think it frees them from learned helplessness, but I can recognize the moments that are hard for them and I can change them. And I think if a horse is used to learned helplessness, I think working with enriched environments and working with programs that empower them to be able to handle stimuli in the environment by themselves is a very, very good tool as well. Hand in hand with looking at the body posture and the features and all that. Yeah,
build self-esteem. Yeah. So how did you transition then from watching these videos over months, understanding that you had something with calming signals? What was the next step for you? Because now you've got a lot of different variables. You've found learned helplessness and things like that as well. What did you do once you found calming signals in horses? What was the next step for you?
I think it was slowly expanding practical practice with horses who had problems. And I did that. And obviously, I did do a lot of writing to get my book on the market. And this is very egocentric thinking of me. But I could not believe that I was one of the first that would be able to publish it. So I thought, I really have to be quick doing this. So writing was also one of my activities in those days.
Yeah.
And practicing with horses. And one of the things I'm really doing a lot also is the scent work with horses. And scent work, you can think of man trailing, where I'm teaching a horse to follow a footstep trail, to follow lost persons or a lost food bag.
Wow.
And that is something that is amazing to do. And it helps the horses a lot to find a new way in life and regain a lot of happiness. And it's a wonderful, wonderful tool to do. Yeah.
Following a scent.
But, yeah.
Like a smell.
But bear in mind, before I forget, and I really have to do this because I'm so enthusiastic talking with you.
Good.
The underlying foundation of this was in Turrets education, International Dog Trainers education, and it was in Annelien Kramp's nosework education. And I build it upon that because I really want to acknowledge that at all, because I would feel it horrible to not having said that.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Those who gave you the inspiration and foundation
absolutely
to do this incredible work, definitely.
And then to adapt it. And same goes with the scent trailing, because it's, to me, it is also, but that's a little bit of a different subject.
Want to hear more about it.
Oh, okay.
Fascinated.
Oh, okay. What I find, mesmerizing with scent training is that it gives so many tools for our daily living. What you can think of scent training is, for instance, when you teach a horse to follow a footstep trail. And you can imagine a horse used to be an animal that would search for food, for water, for herbs. He would know what to eat and what not to eat. So searching would be a very big part of his life, searching for family members, sexual partners.
Mm-hmm.
And we don't use that search seeking system. We don't use it that much. And when you start, teaching them sounds a little bit arrogant, right? Because they already have the ability, but some of them forgot a little bit. They don't use the nose anymore.
It's like reawakening.
Yeah, really. And if they start to use it again, they get so enthusiastic. And I find that searching is very helpful in my work with horses. So for instance, a horse with separation anxiety who doesn't want to leave the herd, I would do many search games with him so that he would know how much fun it is to do something by himself. And searching produces a lot of dopamine in the brain. So it's a feel-good thing to do. It makes them concentrate longer. The socialization goes very well because they smell objects, they smell the environment. Bodily, it's very, very good because they do it with very active relaxation. So you can imagine when a horse searches, his nose is on the ground and he walks in active relaxation. So you have a very lengthened neck and back. And his back is stretched. His hind legs go under. His front legs are a little bit lifted. And everything is really loose and swagging. And that is very, very good for them physically as well. Mm. But mentally, I also found that searching is very calming for them. So if I would have a warm blood horse that is a little bit spooky and is a professional dressage horse, and if I do scent work with him twice a week, the other days as well, he isn't as spooky. He's more calm and more cooperative. So it does do something in the brain, which is, I don't know yet what it is, but in practice I can see it. So absolute great tool. Yeah.
That's fascinating. And does it also make the horse more inquisitive about its world around it? So instead of seeing something as big and scary over there, does it make it them more confident and calm in being able to approach something new?
Yes, but also within limits, obviously, because if it would have been something he's never seen that's really over threshold, then probably search will not help.
Yeah.
But if you do a lot of enriched environments and a lot of searching and he sees something new and I say, oh, well, just look for search or have a go, then he will switch it on and he will go searching. They get more curious, which is an absolute benefit.
Yeah, I can see how it's got so many positives.
Yeah. Yeah.
And tell us.
But also.
Yeah. Yeah. Now you go.
No, I was also thinking, but it is also about finding a new balance a bit, though, because you give them an enriched environment, you give them freedom to explore. So some horses can also be like, oh, yes, I love life. And then you go like, oh, but now you have to listen to me also. So there can be a little bit of a gray area where you have to set boundaries that you go. To me, with my horse, for instance, I had this idea of giving him a choice that day to say, like, okay, whatever you want to do, you can do. And I think I'm quite patient, but after it was near a forest, so he could have walked in a forest, he could have eaten grass, he could have gone to horses, he could have done whatever he wanted. And the next 3.5 hours, he ate grass, and I was standing next to him. And I was so bored. And then I thought, like, okay, this idea is wonderful, but not for me all the time.
Yeah.
So to me, I give cues and I give a cue like, okay, your turn. And he can take lead while walking in the forest or while riding, choosing a way or while investigating. And when I say, okay, my turn, then we do the things I want to do. Because with my horse, I needed that balance and that clearance. Yep.
But that's relationship as well, isn't it? It's collaboration.
Yeah, maybe. Yeah, true. Yeah,
that's very normal. And so I could see how this would be done in a dog. I could see how you would use scent and you could train them. Can you talk me through how you train a horse to do this in simple terms?
In simple terms.
I can see it happening, but I can't in my mind see how I would actually.
Yeah.
Do the step.
Well, the most simple things to do when searching, and I think everyone did that at one point in their life, is throwing pieces of food in the pasture where they can look, treat search.
Mm-hmm.
That is not a problem at all. You can make a scent garden where you can put all kinds of scents in the pasture where they can smell, but you have to dilute it very, very much with water because otherwise they avoid the scent. And if you do the man trailing, I'm a little bit hesitant to tell the steps, but I will do it I will give you anyhow, because I give a day lecture about it with a lot of films, because it is a little bit more tricky to teach it the right
way.
But
if you give us an idea, don't give us all the whole because it takes a whole day to teach it.
Exactly. But the main difference with horses and dogs is that a dog uses his eyes and his nose quite frequently. And a horse, when starting this, some of them don't use their nose. So if you would only use sight and then, for instance, have a food bag, have sight and then pull it out of sight, and you think like, oh, if he doesn't see it, he will use his nose. That in very many cases will not happen. A dog will think like, oh, I cannot see it. Let's use my nose and I'll find it. And a horse will see, oh, I cannot see it. Well, leave it. So when I start man trailing, I start with smell only. And I bury a bag of food with an opening, and I place the horse quite close to it. I have a small white cloth where he can have a starting point. And then I use the wind, and I hope he gets the wind and the smell of the bag, and he goes towards the bag and finds the bag. And then within steps, there is this moment where he cannot smell the apples anymore. And then he figures out, hey, the footsteps go to the apples or the food bag or the person.
Wow.
And then you lengthen in steps the food bag, the footsteps and the trail. But one thing, though, to keep in mind is that horses are so different than dogs, because a well-socialized dog, if they see their owner, they're happy. Even if their life isn't that well, they're happy. Mm-hmm. A horse sometimes, when they find their owner or see the owner, they turn away. Or they think, oh, there's someone hiding behind the bushes. Looks like my owner, but I don't know for sure. And they will turn away. So you have to do much more work to get them accustomed towards people hiding. Because if you want to train them for searching for lost persons, the lost persons might be hiding behind a tree or within a bush. And that is obviously something that scares them in the beginning.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
So
yeah,
it's because they're prey animals as well, and they're thinking about, is this a threat and things like that. You're kind of switching those things off or turning them around in a way and getting them to be inquisitive and go towards it. It's extraordinary.
Yeah. 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 Absolutely. You're absolutely right on that one. Yeah. But a great game to do. Really great game. Yeah.
Yeah, it sounds like
also with
fun.
Yeah, it is. Yeah.
How long does it
so
take
a whole different
to teach
topic.
Your horse that? So how long would it take you to teach a horse? Like you teach people how to do it in a day, but if say I was to do your day course and then I was to start it with my horse, can you teach them that kind of thing?
Well, the thing with scenting is that it's quite tiring. So you cannot have lengthened sessions. Mm. So you would have in the beginning short sessions of a few minutes per go. So maybe in the morning a short session, or in the afternoon, or if I work with my clients, I would have twice a week. That would be ideally. And we would take two sessions of 6 minutes, maybe. Mm-hmm. That was it. And obviously when they are more advanced, they can concentrate longer, they can trail longer, and then they can have longer trails and they can concentrate and search for 15 or 20 minutes on a row. But in the beginning, that is very hard for them. But I think within most of the time, within 8 or 9 sessions, you can have them follow a scent trail of about in the arena of about 15 meters and with two curves in it.
Fantastic. Yeah.
But a horse that is really tired, or a horse that's chronically stressed, it's very hard for them to find the mental calmness to do the search. So the 7 or 8 times is with a horse that is relatively calm and in a good homeostasis.
Mm. It's really interesting that you started studying and found calming signals, but now you've found another thing that you can do with horses that actually helps to calm them. It's amazing.
Yeah. But actually, to me, it is the how do you say that? In Dutch we have this wonderful word, I don't know in English, but it's one of the foundations of my working with horses, because it's right in line with the calming signals, because the calming signals is a way to really assess and adjust and see what the horse can handle with all the wishes in our daily work. And you really want to find something that, well, gives them a very good balance in life, emotionally, mentally, physically. And looking at calming signals and working with calming signals, working with scent and working with enriched environments does all that as well. And I think it's a new tool to implement within trainings and within behavioral consultations as well. Because you can work with a horse with separation anxiety, with seeking, with trailing, when looking at body language, and then solve a problem. A horse that has problems with new stimuli or saddles, you can combine looking at calming signals and the way you treat as a human and make a program about that. And you can make an enrichment program for the horse to be more empowered and more able to handle stimuli. Mm-hmm. So to me, it is one package deal, the enriched environments, the scenting, and the calming signals when working.
Absolutely. Yep. And the enriched environments, yep. Is that what you were talking about with planting the garden and things like that?
Yeah, the scent garden is something that is with the use of smells that you make an enrichment. Mm-hmm. Well, there's a beautiful word, but it's enrichment for me is finding a lot of trash and using it wisely to make a program for your horse to get curious and wanting to investigate. So you find safe items and you place them in the arena or in the pasture. You guide the horse in, and then you're like the director, right? You try to find stuff that are stimulating him to investigate. Should not be too easy, but should definitely not be too hard. Mm-hmm. And the perfect session would be that he truly enjoys it and investigates. And maybe even more perfect would be that he finds something a little bit hard and he goes over his own threshold and investigates and finds himself the best horse in the world to be able to do it by himself. So there are steps in that as well. You can have different materials on the floor. You can have different materials hanging in the wind. You can have different materials that make noises. You can incorporate games that involve noise. Because a lot of times horses get spooked because noises are happening and sounds are happening to them. But if they create sounds and they understand where sounds come from, that can help them as well. So, for instance, I have a game with a lot of crates. And you start, obviously, with one crate and maybe a few plastic bottles in them. And you put an apple in it. And the horse can find the apple by pushing the plastic bottles away, which obviously makes a noise. Then you can, at the end, in steps, create a lot of crates with objects in them, and the horse can push the grates to the floor to get to the apple. And every time he pushes a grate to the floor, it makes a noise. Mm. So then he knows, like, falling bottles make this noise. Hey, the cans of beer make that noise, and they shimmer like that. And that's a good tool as well. So I use enriched environments a lot. Yep. Also to assess horses and to see how curious they are, how brave, how they do need help from the owner, or if they skip the owner. And it's a wonderful tool to use.
Yep. Amazing. You also say that you use no punishments or any form of force when working. Tell me more about that.
Let's see if I can have a practical example. Well, I think I always try to find solutions without having to need to get the flight instinct active. And I do not want to. And if you do not want to provoke a flight instinct, you will not use maybe whips or spurs or anything painful. So I try to find solutions in that way. But I'm thinking if I can find a practical example. Mm. of one way and the other. Well, maybe, for instance, riding out.
Mm-hmm.
If I would ride out and my horse is scared about something, I would not spur him and whip him to pass it, because maybe you're in a group and you feel embarrassed that your horse is the only one standing still and having trouble. I would ask the others to wait. I would ask, maybe if we're in a rush, maybe ask another horse to be a splitter, or have my horse within the group that he feels safe enough to pass. If I would be alone, I would wait for him to take his time to be comfortable enough to investigate. Or if that would not work, I might get off and walk with him, be the splitter while walking. Or if it would be really, really, really too hard, I would turn around and go home. And I would obviously remember what the scary thing was to make a program. So it's not about avoidance, but it's about how can I, while riding, get a positive emotion and as less stress as possible, and then train. And obviously there is a misunderstanding that people think like, oh, you should avoid stress all times. I don't think that at all. I mean, having new stimuli around you gives so much joy in life, and it's needed for humans, for dogs, for people to feel nice. I mean, if my life would be the same every day, I would feel so bored.
Yeah.
But it's all about balance.
It's about growth, yeah, as well. We can't grow, yeah, unless we get into an uncomfortable place within, yeah, ourselves. And
absolutely. Absolutely. But it is about balance, isn't it? And if there was if a horse had a day that he went to a fair or that you went to a competition, maybe it takes him 1-2 days to recover and be in total homeostasis again. And then you can say, okay, let's do something else. And if you went away on a contest on Sunday, maybe do something very simple on Monday, something simple on Tuesday, and do something harder on Wednesday again. It's all about balancing out the week.
Mm.
Is that a...
That's a great answer. And what I love is that there's so much more with the work that you're doing and all the people before you have done to lead you to this, about just understanding. It really is an understanding that horses get scared of stuff and they have a threshold, yeah, and they just can't go past it, and they just need,
yeah,
support and calmness and someone who, yeah, understands to help them get through it. And a stronger bit is and a bigger whip, and you know, forcing them through it doesn't really lead to an inquisitive, open, happy horse.
No, no. And in a way, that is also a choice, isn't it? On how do we want to have a relationship with our horse? Because there are a lot of people who would say, well, if I would use the whip of the spurs, and I do it more often, my horse gets used to it. And obviously, when a horse has a very light fear, and you would spur him on, he would do it, maybe in some circumstances. He would pass that object where I was talking about a little bit sooner.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe there is then that point of habituation that he will cope. And then the rider says, like, see, that spur and that whip was really necessary, because now he did cope. And I think with light fears, he might have a point. But to me, why do that? It's an ethical choice then as well not to do it. And with animals with bigger fear, it always creates a negative learning climate, and also a negative impact on your relationship. So it would not be my choice. No.
Yeah, and that's what I love, yeah, about the work that you're doing. It gets us to really stop and think of our horse's, yeah, point of view. What kind of relationship do we want with our horse? Is it a collaboration or is it a dominant, yeah, one? Because you, yeah, can have both, yeah, and you can be perceived as being successful in both, and it's your choice as to which one it is you would, yeah, like to go forward with. And
absolutely, yeah.
And more people are becoming disillusioned with the horse world and the traditional ways, simply because we say, this isn't how I imagined it when I was a kid. This is
not
the relationship I wanted. You know, I didn't want to get bucked off. I didn't want to be scared of horses. You know, there's so many people who go in thinking, yes, this is great. They go for all the lessons. They do what they're told. They get bucked off and they have fear for their life. And it doesn't have to be that way. There is this amazing work coming out. Thank you to you and the people before you where we can have what it is that we want. It's amazing.
Yeah, and I so agree with you because I meet so many people who really want to be in harmony with their horse, but it's sometimes so hard. And we all have the feeling that you have a wonderful plan and something goes wrong and you feel very, very bad the whole day. And the day after, everything goes smoothly and you feel so happy because we all have this urge, don't you think, that we really want to connect with it in a pleasant way with our animal.
It is the reason we're there in the first place. It is, we all have. I think every horse person has those dreams when they're a kid. And if they had horses when they were kids, it wasn't about, you know, the test or the event that they went to. It was about hanging out with their pony under a tree on their back, you know, eating apples together and and, you know, taking off, and if you were lucky, jumping a few trees on the way home. You know, it was never about the competition. It was about that feeling of freedom and oneness that you got when you're a child. And so many of us desperately want that, but we haven't had until now. Until these years and the type of work that you and many others now, thanks to you guys, are doing, we haven't had a way. And I think there's been a lot of frustration in finding the way, but I'm just so glad that it's here.
Well, thank you so much for it, And I think you're so right. There's so many people now looking for that meaningful relationship. I mean, and do justice to the animal. I mean, I meet many, many people. And that's one of the advantages, I would say, to my life now. It's when I get invited and meeting other professionals, we're almost all on the same quest. And that is such a wonderful thing to look forward to in the future.
It really is. And you put, you know, owning a horse is not a cheap or short amount of time in your life. It takes a lot of time to have horses and to put work into it and money into them, you know, to make sure they're getting all the care and everything's okay with them. So if we're having that, you really want to get something special out of it as in that collaboration and relationship. And this kind of work really allows us to have that.
True. And I do think, I also think, also with the calming signals, and if you start using the calming signals in your work as profession, you can also do it when you're a professional rider or you have a professional stable selling off horses. Because I sometimes get the feeling that people think, oh, it's only for the people who want to walk the horse and do nothing with the horse anyhow. But the knowledge of the calming signals, working with the calming signals, building enriched environments, doing scent trails, it's worth for every horse and every horse owner and every stable. Because they can, well, all horses benefit from it.
Yeah, whether they're, you know, the top of the world competition horses down to, you know, the hacking out once every couple of weeks horse, I think everyone
can benefit. True, yeah.
And is there anything else that you're finding, studying, looking into at the moment that you you want to give us a little snippet?
Well, at the moment, I have assumptions. I'm very, but a lot of, not a lot, but a few research are really looking into it. I'm so excited about that. But I'm personally very interested in the differences in posture of the horse and facial expressions between pain, learned helplessness, and tiredness. Those three can look the same. But obviously, they're quite different.
Yeah.
So that would be a big point of interest to me. And on a very, very detailed level, I'm very interested in looking at mouth seams. That I have the assumption that when a horse is getting into flight mode, that its mouth seam is getting longer. Sometimes it's shorter. So that is something that is an interest to me. And there's still so many questions I have. For the coming period, I am working on my day to give a lecture in June. It's all about the mental stimulation and the scent work. And I hope to write a book about that one. And I also hope to write some practical weekends for people who want to practice all the things I write, because there's so much more to tell about practicing with calming signals. And I had a set pages of my book, and it could not exceed those pages, but there's so much more to tell about practicing with horses and using the calming signals. So I would love to expand that as well. But as you know, there are only so many hours a day, so it's just continuing working, but it's a labor of love, so that it's no problem at all.
Yeah, and it's fantastic. Yeah. And we certainly look forward to all of the things that you're going to bring forth.
Oh, thank you.
It's extraordinary. And I did say to you before we started recording, the amount of people on this podcast who actually reference your work and who how your book has inspired them to do so much in the horse world. It's extraordinary what it is that you've done. And I can tell you from personal experience of the people that I've spoken to, your work has made a real difference in the horse world. It's amazing. Oh, so thank you for that everything that you've done.
Oh, thank you so much. I feel so blessed and honored to hear that. Because in a way, as I told you, I'm living in Millsbeek in a small city, and you don't hear that very often, and I live my life and do my thing. So it's quite special to hear that it influences so many people, even at the other side of the world to me.
And because now we have these mediums like books and podcasts and online learning, it is, you are literally getting to almost every corner of the world, which is just the best thing ever. There's so many people out there who don't know what to do and who don't like what's around them, and they can access this kind of work. So you really are penetrating the horse world in such a fantastic and wonderful way, and
a lot
bigger than you think as well. So thank you, Rachel, so much for your time today, but mostly thank you so much for everything you've done and will do in the future as well. I look forward to keeping an eye on what it is that you're doing and getting you on again to speak about new things that you're thinking and finding, because you're preaching to a converted audience here. We love the work you do.
Wonderful. And thank you so much for the opportunity to talk about my study. I hope I didn't talk too fast because I got too enthusiastic, but I love to share my passion, and it's lovely to talk to you, and you have the same passion. So then talking goes fluently, right?
It does. It does. It was
very, very nice.
You most certainly did not talk too fast, but you were absolutely fascinating. Good. And hearing your story was just magic. And I know the listeners are going to love it as much as I did. So thank you so much.
I hope so. Thank you very much, Tracy.
To connect with Rachel, simply go to the show notes and click the links there. I'm on a mission to create a community of gentle and ethical horse people so that their horses all over the world can live a better life. This is a big mission with a wonderful message, and it needs your help. If you enjoy this podcast and would like to join me on my mission of making the world a better place for horses, please engage with me somehow. You can leave a review on iTunes or Facebook, share or comment on social media posts, or tell your friends about the podcast. You'll find all the links to our social media on our website, comealongfortheride.com.au. We are on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, and you'll find me on LinkedIn. If your friends don't know how to podcast, send them to my website and tell them to hit play. It's the most user-friendly way to listen for anyone you know who'd love to listen but isn't quite sure how. I'd also love it, really love it, if you get in touch and say hi. Let me know who you'd like to hear interviewed on the podcast. I have some wonderful people lined up to speak to, but this is your show as much as mine. So please, if there's anyone you'd like to hear from, get in touch via the website or social media. If there's a topic you'd like me to cover, if there's something you'd like me to research more and really speak about at length or even just in a short way, let me know. I'd love, love, love to serve you guys more. Anyway, thanks again for listening, and I'll catch you next time on Come Along for the Ride.